My guest is writer John Nichols. He lives in Taos, New Mexico, the setting of his trilogy that explores the conflicts between the Native Americans, the Chicanos, the hippies, and the land developers in that region. It was through his work as an investigative reporter that Nichols became active in the land and water rights conflicts that dominated northern New Mexico politics. He sided with the Native American and Chicano farmers who were being pressured by developers to relinquish their water rights. That clash was the subject of the Milagro Beanfield War, the first installment of his trilogy. It's just been made into a movie by Robert Redford, starring Ruben Blades and Sonia Braga. It's scheduled to open in the fall. Nichols wrote the screenplay. That's his third venture in films. His first published book, The Sterile Cuckoo, was made into a movie starring Liza Minnelli. Nichols also did the final rewrite on the screenplay for Missing. John Nichols' new novel is American Blood. It starts off in Vietnam, where a small group of American soldiers commits a string of atrocities and sexual mutilations. The book follows two soldiers after they return home. One soldier continues to play out his Vietnam behavior. The main character is attracted to and repulsed by violence and doubts his control over his impulses. The book has graphic scenes of violence and sex. American Blood has just been published by Henry Holt. John Nichols, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thanks a lot.
Every conceivable atrocity is committed in the first few pages of your new novel. And I'm wondering if any Vietnam veterans are getting angry with you about the book, because in a way that's just the image that veterans have been trying to change.
Yeah, I don't. The book has been out for about a month now, so I haven't gotten a whole lot of reaction. I'm not really tuned in, I guess, to a real wide range of reactions. People that I've talked to who were involved in the Vietnam War, most of them have had a fairly sympathetic reaction to the book. Nobody has said that this is really, you know, a bunch of lies or that it wasn't that way at all. Some people have said, well, do you mean this more metaphorically in that you've telescoped an awful lot of atrocity into the experience of a single soldier? But otherwise, people seem to feel that it's fairly accurate, either realistically or metaphorically, about the whole mood and history of the war.
Well, the book seems to be about, in a way, how immersion into violence through participating in a war keeps you in a violent state of mind, and it's about bringing the violence home from the war.
Whole theory about the book, basically, is it's too bad that the book has been interpreted so much as a Vietnam novel, because the way I see it, Vietnam is simply a metaphor for 450 years of American history, and what I perceive as the violence of Vietnam is not something that originated in the war in Vietnam, but that is obviously a real integral part of our culture, and that's where it's birthed. You know, the problem with the narrator in the book who goes through all these atrocities in Vietnam and then returns to the United States is that he cannot leave the war simply because the foundations of the war are in American culture, not Southeast Asia.
In a way, I was thinking that the book might have an interesting personal meaning for you, and I was wondering if, I know that you're not a veteran yourself, but I was wondering if you feared that had you gone to war, that you would be unable to shake the violence that you were exposed to there.
No.
And here's why I ask you that. I've been reading some of your memoirs, and you were exposed to guns and stuff like that when you were young, and in describing your childhood, you wrote that you and your cousins grew up by a pond. We grew bloodthirsty together, and you describe, you know, shooting at barn swallows. And
oh yeah, I was brought up handling guns. I was brought up hunting, and when I was much younger, though I was raised to take, you know, real good care of guns and stuff like that, to be aware of safety, I was brought up duck hunting, upland game hunting, things like that. There was a certain part of my childhood where myself and my cousins, yeah, we just marauded through the woods when we realized nobody was looking and shot everything that moved simply as sport to practice. That's pretty common in this country. I never really liked the film The Deer Hunter because I felt politically it was real off base, but one of the scenes in The Deer Hunter, that I thought was real accurate of just a strain of American culture is when these guys go off hunting, you know, and they're driving around in a Jeep, being real careless with guns, they're drinking beer. That whole careless attitude about violence and killing things is real prevalent in our culture.
You also wrote that in the late 60s, when you were leaving New York to move to New Mexico, you wrote that you were afraid if you stayed in New York, you would have either committed suicide or hit the streets with an indiscriminately blazing rifle.
Yeah,
I keep getting this feeling that you have all these violent impulses yourself that you're trying to come to terms with.
I don't think it's quite that personal. I think I grew up in a very violent culture. I was, for example, I was very athletic. I played 3 varsity sports a year all through high school and all through college. I played football. I played hockey. I also ran track. In football and hockey, I was trained into a whole lot of aggressiveness. You know, in schooling, I was trained into a whole lot of aggressiveness. The fact of the matter is we live in a society which teaches people to be extraordinarily violent. It may not be that you are taught to actually put on a pair of brass knuckles and you know, bash your way to the top of the corporate ladder that way, but in a sense, people tear each other apart in an almost feral manner in order to get to the top or to win or whatever, you know, in our society. So certainly this country, for example, in Vietnam, it took us, I think, 13 years to kill 58,000 American soldiers. In our nation, I think the statistics are something like 50,000 people a year are murdered in our country, you know, yearly. We don't raise as big a stink. We kill 50,000 or 40,000 people a year in car accidents, and we maim and mutilate sort of 250,000 more. We accept an extraordinary amount of carnage in the United States. A couple of years ago, even in the Reagan administration, issued a report on violence, which said the United States was by far the most violent nation in the world in terms of murder, rape, armed robbery, battery, assault, things like that. We were 10 times more violent than Japan, 6 times more than West Germany.
One of the paradoxes of writing a novel about violence is that in writing about it, you add to the violence that exists. You have some very explicit violent scenes and sexual mutilation scenes.
Uh-huh. Well, there's you know, if you're a cultural worker trying to make certain kinds of statements, sometimes would you say, for example, that Picasso's Guernica adds to violence or it's a statement against violence? You know, here is a painting that has been accepted almost as a symbol of anti-war, anti-fascist art, all right? It's about, you know, the painting has extraordinary violence in it. Goya did a whole series of etchings, lithographs of extraordinary violence and mutilation and brutality and rape and cruelty in his whole series on the horrors of war, which depict the Napoleonic invasion of Spain. Somebody like Dalton Trumbo writing Johnny Got His Gun. This book is almost unreadable because a person is so mutilated, and yet it's a very strong anti-war statement. I don't know if you've ever seen a film like Peter Watkins' The War Game, which is an attempt to recreate the effects of a nuclear holocaust in Britain. The film is terrible to watch. It's very violent. You know, you've got firestorms. You've got people being blown through plate glass windows. You've got splinters of straw going through people's skulls or whatever, you know. But is the point of that to add to the violence? You know, basically you come out of it with a total aversion to violence or the possibility of nuclear war, and it becomes a very strong anti-war, anti-violence statement, unlike something like Rambo or you know, the Dukes of Hazzard or whatever.
John Nichols is my guest. His new novel is called American Blood. Our listeners might be familiar with your New Mexico trilogy that includes the Milagro Beanfield War that's just been made into a movie, and The Magic Journey, and Nirvana Blues. Now, you moved to New Mexico from New York in 1969. Mm-hmm. It's funny, it was a place that was attracting a lot of people in 1969. It had become a kind of mecca for the counterculture.
When I decided to leave New York City and go to New Mexico, my reasons were basically political. I wanted to go to a place that, for me, was kind of like a colonial country. It was very close to third world situation because so much of its population was poor and exploited. And I wanted to work politically. That was the time of Reyes Tijerina's land-grant movement, which culminated in the armed raid on the Tierra Maria courthouse, which is quite famous. The last, or one of the only, I think, insurrections, what we call local insurrections in the United States in the 20th century, armed insurrections. So I went to New Mexico to work politically with what was going on there. I had no idea that the rest of the nation, you know, that wasn't leaving New York City and retiring in upstate Vermont or going to the base of Mount Tamalpais in California, was emigrating to New Mexico. That took me quite by surprise.
What kind of conflicts existed then between the hippies who had come to New Mexico, the Native Americans and the Chicanos who lived there, and the land developers who were getting started there?
Let's see, background on New Mexico. Like I mentioned, New Mexico is very poor. It's 46, at that time it was 49th out of 50 states in terms of poverty. It's a state where 5% of the state's population controls about 80% of the wealth. About 60% of the population is minority peoples. It's Chicano or Native American peoples. In what you're talking about, many freaks, hippies, long hairs came to northern New Mexico. These were people who wanted to flee often urban existence. They were a lot of people, you know, the cliches. They had trust funds. They were poor little rich kids. Most of them had college educations. Many of them had built up piles of money, let's say, I don't know, selling stocks on margin in New York City or Los Angeles. Some of them had PhDs, but were really sick and tired of the competition in the big city atmosphere. So they voluntarily chose to move into one of the nation's poorest areas. And northern New Mexico is as poor as any other section of the country. The only thing that could compare is maybe Beaufort, South Carolina, or some counties in Mississippi, right? And these people came into the area choosing to be poor, and which immediately set up a kind of hostility between them and local citizens who were desperately, you know, just trying to get enough to eat and move up in the world.
And they saw it as play poverty?
Play poverty. It was play poverty, sure. You know, and most of the freaks came into the area and hung around for about a year or 6 months or 2 years and discovered that poverty is really ugly. It's no fun, you know?
How is what you're describing different from what you were doing when you came down from New York? Because you were educated, came from an educated background, your family had lived comfortably.
Oh, sure, yeah. I'm a middle-class, white, Anglo-Saxon, Protestant, you know, white man, sure.
Did you get into the same kind of conflicts that you were describing, though? Do you think that you were doing play poverty?
Well, first of all, I wasn't into poverty or whatever. I mean, when I moved to New Mexico, I did not have much money, right? But I hadn't sold a book in 3 years, but I did not walk around you know, trying to live in a commune or anything like that. That never interested me at all. I was trying to sell books and earn a living, that kind of thing. I didn't manage to sell another book until, 1973, I guess. But no, what I was doing essentially was trying to work with people, organizers, different groups in New Mexico, mostly in social struggles, whether they were social struggles around land and water rights, you know, local people trying to protect their irrigation rights or stuff like that, or whether people were trying to protect their human rights. And so I devoted a lot of time to a whole bunch of different groups, the same as I'd done in New York City. I mean, when I was in New York, most of my time, I suppose, was involved in organizing against the Vietnam War. And to that effect, I worked with groups as diverse as the Moratorium, SANE. I remember working for a peace candidate in Brooklyn named Mel Dubin, who was the first of kind of the peace candidates who tried to run and lost. And I continued, you know, operating in that fashion. Most freaks or most hippies that came to the Taos area were totally disinterested in the social situation, the economic situation. They were simply absorbed in their own lives and their own shtick. Most of them also were totally ignorant, let's say, of Native American and Chicano culture and stepped all over it. You know, they had no desire to participate or become a part of the community on the terms of the community that they were entering. They simply walked in and said, you know, we're all peace, love, groovy people, and if you don't like it, you can all go bleep yourselves.
Did you become a mediator at all between those cultures?
When I first moved to Taos, I was real disposed to be friendly towards long hairs and that whole countercultural movement. After about 6 months, I became very turned off by it, and there really wasn't much mediating you could do except to encourage the freaks to leave. To get out of there, that they had no business. They were so disruptive, and they managed, you know, just their presence and their arrogance sabotaged an awful lot of social struggle in the valley, in the Taos Valley.
My guest is writer John Nichols, who's the author of The Milagro Beanfield War and a new novel called American Blood. John, we're going to take a short break, and we'll be back in a few seconds. This is Fresh Air. My guest is novelist John Nichols. His 1974 novel, The Milagro Beanfield War, has just been made into a movie by Robert Redford. His new novel, American Blood, follows two soldiers home from the Vietnam War. Well, we were just talking about your early days in New Mexico, and one of the novels that you wrote based on the water rights struggle between the land developers and the Chicanos, the Milagro Beanfield War, has just been made into a movie. There's, briefly, is there a story that the novel and the book is based, the novel and the movie is based on?
Yeah, there's a whole bunch of stories in the Taos Valley in northern New Mexico. In particular, I spent about 8 years working with a group called the Tres Rios Association in Taos, which was a group of small farmers and irrigators on the ditch systems in the valley, struggling against the imposition of a conservancy district on the Taos Valley and the building of a major dam and recreation irrigation lake as a result of that. And the small farmers of Taos fought it for about 8 to 10 years and finally defeated it.
The script is, the movie was directed by Robert Redford. The way I understand it, the rights to your novel were optioned years ago, and the option kept getting renewed, but the movie wasn't getting made. What happened?
It took 14 years to make the film. Basically, it's real difficult to make any film. In this particular instance, it was real difficult to get the film off the ground, partially because the film features a lot of Chicanos as heroes. They basically derail or overthrow some major tenets of our economic system, which, you know, progress is our most important product, and a lot of people fight against that and eventually manage to defeat it. Hollywood has long been a pretty reactionary industry. You could probably name on half the fingers of one hand the number of films you've seen featuring minorities, Hispanics, Latinos, or Chicanos, which treat them with dignity or intelligence. It just doesn't exist. For that reason, I mean, one of the major problems in raising money for the film was that most people said, who wants to see a movie about a bunch of Mexicans? And another problem is probably the politics inherent in the novel. It's a very humorous book, and yet basically what it's talking about is class struggle. It's talking about people trying to avoid cultural genocide, and it's talking about the values of a way of life which are quite antithetical to the values of the way of life that's expostulated by the mainstream culture in this country.
There are times when, in order to make a movie good box office, the suggestion is to cast, you know, a big star in it. And I have heard stories where a white person is supposed to be cast as either a Native American or
That's the history of movies up until almost the present.
Right. Did they want to do that with your movie at
all? Sure, yeah. For years, the people who were trying to make the film, who held the option, their names are Bob Christensen and Rick Rosenberg, and they're best known probably for the autobiography of Miss Jane Pittman. So they have a real social conscience. And they were trying to raise money, and when they came close to getting bread, it was usually contingent upon them casting a star in the picture. And the only star that would be acceptable to sort of money people for years was either Al Pacino or Robert De Niro or I think Charles Bronson, someone like that. In other words, not Chicano or Latino actors. And so that was another problem.
You had had experience doing rewrites of scripts. You had done that for Missing.
Mm-hmm.
Did you have people rewriting from your novel for the screenplay for this movie? Did you have final rewrite on it?
No. Basically, when a writer sells a book or puts it out on option, you lose most of your control over it. So I never had any final say or something like that legally. For all the period that the novel was out on film option, I always had a pretty close friendship or relationship with the people involved, so that I was always called in as a consultant to read scripts that were done. First three scripts done in the Milagro Beanfield War were done by other writers other than myself, and none of them were successful. But I critiqued all of them quite heavily, but not through any legal right to do it, simply because Christensen and Rosenberg were friends of mine and extended the courtesy, one, of letting me be involved in the process, and of two, listening to what I had to say. All during the process of having scripts written on this book that were not my own, I felt that my most important role was basically to critique them from the point of view of trying to make sure that nothing patronizing or racist went through. You know, that was very important, because we live in a country where an awful lot of people are simply unaware of how they can be paternalistic or downright racist or patronizing or whatever.
Are you satisfied, and do you think the politics of your book have been watered down in the movie?
I don't know, because I haven't seen the movie. Mm-hmm. It's in, I think they've got a rough cut now, but I have not seen it. I've seen dailies and, you know, rushes of the film, and they're all, the few that I've seen were quite beautiful, or they were quite humorous, or they seem really right on. But you never know until a film is put together how it's going to turn out.
The movie we're talking about is the Milagro Beanfield Wars, and the movie is based on a novel of the same name by my guest John Nichols, whose new novel is called American Blood. What keeps you in New Mexico? You went there in 1969. I don't know that you planned on staying that long.
I didn't plan on staying. You never know, you know, how long you're going to be anywhere. I stay there, I guess, because it's become a real home. I've got real strong roots there. As a novelist, I think it's fairly important to have roots into a place or into a culture, because you get to know it real intimately.
It's interesting to me that you picked a culture that wasn't your own to lay those roots down in, because, you know, it isn't all that unusual for an outsider to come into a place,
mm-hmm,
and see that place differently than people who've always lived there do, mm-hmm, and be able to write about it very perceptively because of that outsider's vision.
Yeah, perhaps. I don't, you know, I've never felt, you know, we live in a country that sort of trains all of us to see all kinds of distinctions in each other and in each other's cultures and stuff like that. I never bought that from a very early age, probably because I come from a family where my mother was French. I mean, you know, natural-born French. She died when I was 2 years old. But nevertheless, half my family comes from Europe. My great-grandfather and my mother were from Brittany, which is also a different culture from the French culture. So I have sort of real strong Breton roots, and then I have pretty strong French cultural roots. I grew up in a family where if you didn't speak at least three languages, it was real shameful, you know. So I speak French, Spanish, and English. My mother was also brought up in Spain. I mean, though they're from France, my grandmother married a French industrialist who moved to Barcelona. My grandmother's buried in Barcelona, that kind of thing. All my little cousins sort of, I mean, they've been brought up in Italy, Switzerland, Spain, France, that kind of thing. So from a real early age on, I pretty much have been a tricultural person. Never felt comfortable any part of my life living in monocultural areas or middle class areas. I've never felt comfortable in an area that didn't have a range of classes, you know, from working class to bourgeois class, etc. Plus, you know, from a real early age on, I mentioned I was in athletics, and I played sports, which meant I played a lot of sports with black people and Spanish-speaking people, you know, Puerto Rican, Cuban, Dominican, or whatever. My heroes growing up, you know, half of them were like Jackie Robinson, Roy Kemp, half of them were black, half of them were white. I was a big hockey fan because I played hockey, so half of them were French-Canadian, that kind of thing. I became a musician at a really early age. My dad sings all kinds of folk songs in French, Russian, Spanish, etc. So, and I don't know, I got into blues guitar real early, which put me into another culture.
Right. We only have a couple of minutes left, and I want to bring the subject back around to your new novel, American Blood, which is about the violence during the war in Vietnam and violence in America.
It's mostly about violence in America.
I want to know if you've had to confront violence directly in your life, if you've been the victim of it or have friends who have, if you've had personal confrontations with it.
Every day. I've been in New York now for 3 days. I don't know, each time I've called home, my wife likes to jog. She's a good-looking woman. She puts on sweat clothes. She cannot jog 3 miles down a public road without having cars stop and people, you know, shout insults at her, make propositions, you know, put obscenities out. Yesterday I called her and she was in the laundromat and 6 sort of punk rockers came in and started doing the same thing, practically accosting her in the laundromat. I don't know a woman in this country. And I know I'm not alone, but acquaintances, wives, ex-wives or whatever, people that hasn't either been assaulted or actually raped.
So those kinds of personal confrontations,
they're daily in this
led
country.
To your interest in writing this book about violence.
Yeah. I mean, every time I pick up, I take personally what is going down to strangers in this country because it affects how I live at every level.
John Nichols, we're out of time. I want to thank you very much for talking with us. Thanks for being here.
Thank you very much.
My guest has been writer John Nichols. He's the author of The Sterile Cuckoo and The Milagro Beanfield War, which has just been made into a movie. His new novel, American Blood, is the story of the violence two men take home after the war in Vietnam. It's published by Henry Holt. This is Fresh Air.